The daily podcast of The Exchange is supported by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. More information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Yesterday's grand jury decision not to indict police officer Darren Wilson for the death of Michael Brown set off a night of protests in Ferguson, Missouri, and cities around the country. Ferguson saw the most chaotic protests with fires, gunshots, looting, and tear gas. Protests are simmering there this morning, and Missouri's Governor Jay Nixon plans to send additional troops into Ferguson. But even as the decision puts an end to 100 days of uncertainty for Brown's family and its supporters, it leaves the question open of what's next for those who see this case as an example of continued racial injustice in this country. Today in The Exchange, we look at this Missouri grand jury decision about the Darren Wilson case and get reaction from around the Granite State. Let's hear from you. Are you surprised by this decision? What do you think? How do you feel about President Obama's statement calling for calm? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio is Buzz Scherr. He's a professor at UNH School of Law with a background in criminal justice and civil rights. Buzz, thanks for coming in last minute. We really appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Dottie Morris, Chief Officer for Diversity and Multiculturalism for Keene State College. And again, Dottie, a big thank you to you.
Thank you very much.
And also with us, David Mara. He's Manchester's police chief. And Police Chief Mara, I know you moved a couple appointments for us this morning, so we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, Dottie, I'll start with you. What's your reaction to this decision?
Wow. I'm at a loss for words for a variety of reasons. The whole idea around, the health and safety of young people, and especially young African-American men, and what does that mean, about how they will respond and how will law enforcement agents respond to them in the future. And I think a lot about, how we've socially constructed who black males are, and including a research study that was just done that showed that black boys are often seen as less innocent and more inclined to be perceived as guilty. And so this is really an illustration about how we worked really hard to tear Michael Brown down without looking at the whole picture. Or the entire community, I think, was indicted long before the police officer was indicted.
So, what do you mean by that, Dottie? The entire community was indicted.
Well, it almost seems like when I heard some of the commentary about Ferguson, it was always in such a negative light. Never, no clear indication that these are hardworking people who are trying to do their best to make a living and to secure for their families. It seems like there was a lot of hype around demonizing the community. And I think that once you do that, it sets up a certain type of complexity that is hard to break down, even when you're looking at the behavior of one individual against another individual. So if the individual is representative or a part of that community that we've demonized, then it's easier to see the person who's the perpetrator or the alleged perpetrator, as innocent, and that person to be more guilty, more or less being a participant in their own demise.
Well, I definitely want to talk more about this narrative surrounding young black men, because
yes,
we've seen other similar shootings. But first, just your reaction to this decision. Chief Mara, to you, your reaction to the decision that came down and also some of the protests that we saw not only in Missouri but around the country.
Well, my reaction and my ongoing reaction was is in my position here, being a law enforcement chief in New Hampshire, you might say, hey, we are not going to face those issues. That it really doesn't. It's apples and oranges, but it really isn't. What I look at while this was ongoing was, how did they get to that point?
Mm-hmm.
Before Michael Brown was shot. How did the police department and the community get to that point? There's obviously there were some issues, there were some severe problems, there was distrust. It was two different entities. You had the police department and you had the community, where it should be one, the police department being part of the community. So right away, there were problems, and there was a recipe, I think, for disaster. There was distrust of the police department. There was no communication, evidently, between the community, which was made up, comprised of, I might be getting these numbers wrong, 70% African American. There are just a lot of things that was a recipe for what happened. And as far as my reaction to what I saw last night, I was horrified in a number of ways by the way people behaved, but what kept me, what while I was watching it, what I kept on hearing, and to me was good to hear, there were protesters out there, true protesters, that were trying to stop the people from looting, trying to stop the people that were predisposed to damage property. So you can't lump all what happened there. As Dottie was saying, you can't just say the whole community of Ferguson was out there looting and burning things down, because there was a pretty good contingent of people there protested that were trying to stop that, as well as community leaders.
And Buzz, I don't want to forget you too, but a quick question for you, Chief Mara. President Obama said, you know, in addition to calling for calm, as Michael Brown's family called for calm as well, he also said the fact remains that in too many parts of the country, a deep distrust exists between police and communities of color. You touched on that in your first answer to my question. Can you give us a little bit more? Do you see this deep distrust between police in Manchester and communities of color there?
Well, I think I'd be foolish or to say there isn't. I think that there are a lot of issues in our society that are here in Manchester, that are here in New Hampshire, that are here and all throughout the country. I try not to see things through my lens, my upbringing, through what my experiences, and that is why I think it's important for law enforcement officials to get the other view, to get people's other views, to see this is what's going on in the different communities. I can't just assume, and that's why it's important for police departments to really get to know their community, to work hard to do that, get the community involved in policing. It's important that everybody in the community feels like this is our police department, and you will be treated the same way as everybody else. If you need help, you get the help you need, and if you're doing something wrong, you get the negative consequences as well, but it's done fairly. And that is an ongoing challenge, and that is what we're striving to do.
I want to get your reaction to Buzz, and then a lot more detail to dive in with all three of you. Yeah, go ahead, Buzz.
I think my first reaction is just sadness. What this is reflective of, for the reasons Dottie talked about and Chief Mara talked about, it's a reflection of 250, 300 years of the government in the United States and the criminal justice system creating an atmosphere where people of color, it's a rational reaction for them not to trust police departments. And it's not specific to Ferguson, although Ferguson, I believe, has particular problems. But broadly, you look at the history of race in the criminal justice system, and people of color have little reason, as a historical proposition, to trust the criminal justice system in any regard. And that's what makes this circumstance so difficult. People put in a lot of good efforts, but the perception is so locked into how the majority white population intuitively and unconsciously reacts when they see a black teenage male or a black male. And that's something that's embedded in everyone in this country, unfortunately. And you look at the history of how blacks have been treated in the criminal justice system. So, the overwhelming reaction for me is just sadness. This is a huge problem. It's not a Ferguson problem. It's not a problem of the 21st century. It's something that we've just struggled and failed at for 200 years.
Now, let me get our listeners' reaction. Then again, a lot more questions for you. As Buzz Scher says, it's not a Ferguson problem. Exchange listeners, what do you think of that statement? And what's your broad reaction to what we saw in Missouri yesterday, either the decision itself or the protests that followed? What does this represent for you? The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. We're taking your questions, comments, thoughts, reactions. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And what do you think about that last point that Buzz Scher made, Dottie Morris? It's not a Ferguson problem.
No. I think it's something that has been in the making, as he said, for many years. And I think that, you know, as part of how we even constructed the you know, when we think about the criminal justice system, you know, post-civil, when we think about the Civil War, and when I think about how, you know, certain laws were created mainly to, you know, kind of control these former slaves, and we still have that very prevalent in our system today. How do we control a group of people? And I think that until we see it as a community problem, again, without looking at the whole picture, I don't think that we'll make a lot of gains. We have to see that it is something that we all directly or indirectly contribute to, and then the only way that we can make changes, those changes have to come from us all coming together. So we can't just demonize the police officer who shot Michael Brown or Michael Brown. We have to look at the whole larger cultural context that created that kind of deadly dynamic.
Go ahead, Buzz.
Yeah, one of the in the facts of this particular circumstance, you know, if you think about, given the history in this country and life in Ferguson, what Michael Brown thought when a police officer approached him,
right,
and you think about what the police officer thought at least at an unconscious level about what was happening in that encounter, they were. It sure seems like both of them may have been afflicted by the way we have so mismanaged people of color's relationship with the police departments around the country.
That narrative that Dottie talked about at the beginning. Okay, and Chief Mara, I have a question for you, too, after a short break. Also, we'll start taking your reaction, your questions, comments, thoughts on this situation. Again, as Buzz Scher said, it represents not just a problem for Ferguson, but an issue concerning the whole country. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Granite State reaction to the grand jury decision in Ferguson concerning the Michael Brown shooting by a police officer, protests that resulted from that, and what this might mean for race relations in our country, what it says about the current state of relations between communities of color and police departments. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Buzz Scher is with us, a professor at UNH School of Law with a background in criminal justice and civil rights. Dottie Morris, chief officer for diversity and multiculturalism for Keene State College. And David Mara, he's Manchester's police chief, and he's been working on these issues for a long time. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. Eric's in Westchester. Go ahead, Eric. You're on the air.
Actually, it's Westchester. Actually.
West Chesterfield, I do apologize, Eric.
That's okay, not a problem. I just want to just a really, really, really quick comment, and I think it underscores this point that that was made, which is this significant global distrust that African American people have of law enforcement and an African American male. One of the greatest challenges I think that we have, particularly as a parent of three African American now grown adults, the adult male, is the significant worry that we have whether or not our children, particularly our sons, will be safe. And that is just safe in every aspect of the word, but particularly when dealing with matters of law enforcement and our criminal justice. And I believe that it cannot be underscored enough the inequities within the legal system, within our criminal justice, in addressing issues particularly that apply to African-American males. Our country's dealing with African-American males just isn't good. And it is simply a terrific fear, a horrible fear, an awful fear that we have as African parents, as African American males, that our sons will not be safe.
Okay, and Eric, thank you for calling in. And two questions to follow up on. First to you, Chief Mara, this idea that, you know, parents like Eric of African-American sons are, you know, afraid to send your sons out, you know? I mean, we've seen situations where unarmed African-American boys have been shot. And you know, later on it turns out they were not armed.
Well, getting to the one of the issues that Eric was talking about, for us, that is the challenge for law enforcement. Even if it wasn't true, even if it isn't true that African American males won't be mistreated by the police or treated differently, just having a parent say that, just having people think that, is just as bad as if it is happening. And it's a challenge for us in law enforcement. It's something that we need to change. Now, as far as New Hampshire goes, what I'm encouraged by in New Hampshire is we don't have all the problems that the rest of the country has. We're a smaller state. Our demographics are different. They're changing drastically, especially here in Manchester. I think you'll see within the next 20, 30 years, the face of Manchester will be totally different. It's changing now. Just look at our elementary schools and look at the face of the children that we have from all over the world. So what we need to do in New Hampshire is let's learn from the mistakes. Ferguson, it's a tragedy, but it also could be an opportunity for us here in New Hampshire to do something that we can do at this point, at this stage in the game. We start talking about race. It's something that people avoid. Things simmer. And then before you know it, you have a Ferguson. I think in New Hampshire, if we all work together, we get enough people working on this issue, this problem. And again, I'm not saying it doesn't exist in New Hampshire. I'd be a fool to say that there isn't any kind of racial discrimination. To say that it would be insulting. However, I think in New Hampshire, what we can do is we can work. We're a small enough state, we're a close enough state where we can work on these issues, and hopefully learn from people's mistakes as well as their successes, and let's see what we can do so there's never a Ferguson in New Hampshire, and that we have to work together. We were starting to, before the verdict came out, and actually we had reached out to Dottie about getting a symposium going in Manchester to talk about what's going on in Ferguson. Sometimes these conversations are difficult, especially for being a chief of police, standing there or sitting there and listening to what people have to say, but it's important to have a public discussion about race relations, a public discussion about distrust about the police and all other issues that come with race. And I think in New Hampshire, that's what we need to do sooner than later to try to avoid problems.
Yeah, hard for you, Chief Mara, to hear parents like Eric call and say, hey, you know, I'm afraid to send my sons out. And it is a hard conversation, and we do appreciate you being with us on that today, all of you. Dottie, what do you think about what Chief Mara says? You know, okay, what can we learn from this for New Hampshire?
And I think that's the important key. That's the key piece right there, is what can we learn? And, you know, I know I'm in on this for the long haul because I feel like I have no other alternative. And I feel as though there are several people in the state who feel the same way, that we do have a lot of potential here because it is a small state. We can talk face-to-face to one another. We could be in each other's presence in order to work through some pretty difficult conversations, and hopefully that can help have an impact on behavior. I also think that we have an opportunity to do a lot of healing where in other places, because it's so large, you can't engage in the process that we need to do. So I think that's the first part, is healing from some of the pain that has existed in order to be able to move forward. And it seems like there are a number of people in the state who are ready, willing, and able to start there so we can build upon a firmer foundation in order to, you know, create something that in a lot of states we just don't have the opportunity to do that.
All right. Well, I want to thank Eric, our caller, for joining us again. 1-800-892-6477. You can call in, email, find us on Facebook or Twitter. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. We're getting New Hampshire reaction to this decision in Ferguson. about the shooting of a young man and the indictment that came down yesterday, or the decision that came down not to indict police officer Darren Wilson. We're taking your reactions and thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. Jonathan's in Concord. Hi, Jonathan. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I work in this state as a defense lawyer, and I wanted to make a comment about the process. Generally speaking, you know, they have the phrase they can indict a ham sandwich because process is one in which a grand jury sits in a room with a prosecutor, and the prosecutor presents the evidence that the prosecutor chooses to present, and the defendant or the target is not aware of what's going on. It does not have a seat at the table, is not able to go in there and present exculpatory evidence. So generally speaking, the process works in a way where most people are indicted when it's presented to a grand jury, and they find out about it afterwards, and the process goes through the courts. In this particular case, there was a tremendous amount of evidence presented to this grand jury, a tremendous amount of exculpatory evidence. And the thing about it is, this means that this particular target, because of his stature as a police officer, was treated differently than an average citizen who was accused of the same thing.
Okay, Jonathan, thank you for calling in. And Buzz Scherr, that one's for you. And I would just add to Jonathan's question, you know, it was heard by a grand jury. What stands out for you about that? How is that process different? And was it handled differently in this instance?
Well, originally the grand jury was the idea behind the grand jury was to interpose a somewhat neutral body of citizens in between an individual and the prosecution, the police, the government, and to protect citizens from being charged at the whim of a prosecutor. That was the theory behind the grand jury. Historically, it's turned out not to be that. It's turned out to be more or less of a rubber stamp where the prosecutor just brings enough evidence to get an indictment. And it, by design, those processes are secret. A defendant doesn't necessarily have a right to be in front of the grand jury. And in many ways, if a defendant goes in front of a grand jury, his testimony at the grand jury gets immunized.
So usually grand juries, then you're saying, work in favor of the accused or the...
No, historically, the idea behind the grand jury was that it protect a potential defendant against an overzealous government. Historically, over the last 100-plus years, it's been just the opposite. It's been used as a tool of the prosecution because the defense has no role whatsoever. So that's kind of the historical context of what a grand jury is. In this case, I think what actually happened is the prosecutor, for better and for worse, made a decision because he appreciated the controversial nature of this, made a decision to just put everything that they could possibly get in front of the grand jury.
Yeah, it was a huge process from what I read.
Yeah, and grand juries don't usually listen in these kind of cases to this amount of testimony. The irony of it is, put aside where the grand jury came down, the irony of it is this was an uncharacteristically broad and inclusive grand jury process that occurred here. I think Jonathan, you know, suggests from his perspective that was because it was a police officer, so we wanted to actually treat the grand jury like it was originally formed to be treated, as a means of protecting an individual against the zealousness of the government. But, you know, I think perception-wise, it's easy to think that they were trying to make this come out a particular way. The membership of the grand jury in this case, 12 people, 9 whites, yeah, 3 blacks. To indict someone, you need a vote of 9, at least 9 votes to indict someone. It doesn't need to be unanimous. So I think we can question the motives of why all of a sudden we had such a thorough investigation by the grand jury, when some might say an African-American teenager who's at risk of being charged would not get this kind of thorough investigation from a grand jury. On the other hand, we like the idea that before we jump into this case, we have a body that, as neutrally as possible, may well have considered as much of the evidence that was available. So the process doesn't tell you the answer, but it raises some more questions.
Well, Jonathan, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Dottie. Yeah.
The thing I was thinking about, you know, the human factor here. And again, the grand jury, it's made up of humans with perceptions, beliefs, misperceptions. And if we look at, you know, who gets chosen, that can play a major role in the outcome. So we could have a great process in place, but the human factor, including the way that we socially construct everything, is in that room when the decision is being made. So I guess I want to make that clear. The process could have been wonderful, and the human factor, meaning people's belief systems, come into play when they make the decision.
Thanks for the call again, Jonathan. Janet's calling in from Troy. Hi, Janet. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I first want to say I'm very sympathetic to the suspicions of the African-American community toward the criminal justice system. However, this is a situation where it sounds like this unfortunate young man put himself in a vulnerable position by wrangling with this police officer. And unfortunately, it sounds like the officer had reasons to be concerned for his safety. It wasn't a random attack upon a black man. And I don't hear your commentators addressing that aspect of this terrible situation.
Janet, thank you so much for calling in. I want to hear from everybody on this. But you first, David Mara.
Well, getting back to the grand jury first, and then I'll address that issue. I think, and this is my observation as a chief of police and as an attorney, I look at the situation the prosecutor was in. Typically, to decide whether or not charges are brought, it's up to the prosecuting entity. In this case, the person questioned there, and if he would have just looked at the evidence, and he would have made a determination, hey, I'm not going to prosecute this. There's not enough here for me to get a conviction on any elements of any crime. If he would have made that decision with the volatile situation that was present in Ferguson at the time, I think things would have been a lot worse. So what he did is made a decision, let's send it to the grand jury. Let's give them everything. Let's give them all the evidence from all sides and let that grand jury decide. And that was the rationale, right or wrong, with it. And, again, whatever decision that grand jury made, there was going to be a significant population of the United States that would be against it, and another significant that would have been for it, depending on what happened. I think that's why it's an unusual circumstance as far as the way this went to grand jury, as it did.
What about Janet's point, Chief Mara, you know, saying, hey, you know, obviously I wasn't there, I didn't hear the testimony, but some of the reports that, you know, that the police officer felt threatened by Michael Brown?
Well, none of us were there. We can only hear the evidence, and we're going to get the opportunity to look at the evidence, what the grand jury has. So everybody has to make their own determination on this. But as far as I do agree with her that this was not a random encounter where we had two young men walking in the middle of the street, and one of them fit the description of somebody that just committed a theft at a store. So it was he did have a reason to stop him.
Here's another question I have for you, and I know Dottie and Buzz want to jump on this too, but what type of training do police have, Chief Mara, about when to pull the trigger? I wonder about, you know, tasers and other non-lethal methods of stopping suspects if police feel threatened.
Well, there's use the least amount of force available at the time with whatever facts and circumstances are present. So if you can, depending on what the fellow's fact and circumstances are, if you can effect an arrest or subdue somebody, say by using a taser or say by verbal commands or for whatever, that is what you're supposed to do. The last option that you are to use is deadly force, and you only use that when you feel your life is in jeopardy, your life and safety, health and safety is in jeopardy, or that of a citizen. And that is what happens. And after something, and after deadly force is used, then it's up to the prosecutor, such as the one in Ferguson. Here it would be the attorney general would make a determination whether or not it was justified, whether or not there were circumstances, facts, circumstances, evidence that would indicate that that was the only option, and that is what you used.
Dottie, I know you want to jump in there. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to address what the caller said. I think we have to understand that feeling threatened, it's very subjective, and it's based on thoughts and beliefs of thinking that someone is threatening. So I have to keep going back to what is going through the officer's mind, what's going through my mind, what's going through anybody's mind when they have the perception that they are being threatened. And so it takes into account who the person is, and the whole circumstances under which the encounter takes place as I determine if I'm threatened or not. I wasn't there either. If the police officer is already kind of hyped up to feel threatened, given some of the things that I've heard, that it's easier, and I put easier in quotes, to use a little more force than you would use if you were in another situation where you don't perceive the person coming at you as threatening, even if they're engaging in the same behaviors. And, you know, there, again, I don't want to refer to research, but there has been research done where it's shown that people are more likely, including college students in a simulation, if they see someone who's African-American, to pull a trigger a lot faster than they see a white person engaging in the same behavior. So I guess I want to add, the human factor and perceptions and how the larger cultural context controls even how and when we feel threatened.
Okay, after a break, Bashir, love your thoughts. Lots more audience reaction, lots of calls, emails coming in. So we will talk more in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Granite State reaction to the grand jury decision in Ferguson and some of the protests that we've seen stemming from this grand jury's decision not to indict the police officer accused of shooting an unarmed black teenager. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Buzz Scher is with us, a professor at UNH School of Law, Dottie Morris, Chief Officer for Diversity and Multiculturalism at Keene State College, and David Mara, Manchester's Police Chief. And all of you, let's go back to our listeners. Janet's calling from York, Maine. Hi, Janet. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
David, the police chief, mentioned working on more of building trust and collaboration with the community and using this as a learning experience. I think one issue is this is an increasing militarization of the equipment available to police stations all across the country from the federal government's their cast-offs. And you mentioned having more, what about tasers, having something less lethal, and yet the move seems to be to have more lethal equipment in police stations than less. And I'll take information off the air.
Yeah, and Janet, we've done programs on this as well, and I did want to acknowledge also an email from Stephen Manchester, who says, if your panel could please comment on the effect that the increasing militarization of our police departments could be having on that trust of the police department within our community. So thanks to you, Janet, and Stephen Manchester for the email. Maybe Buzz, for sure, you first, and then definitely you, David Mara, please. Yeah, go ahead, Buzz.
I think as a perception, the militarization, if you use that term, of some police departments creates the impression that it's a war, it's us against them, it's not a community together solving the problem, it's an us against them circumstance. And Chief Mara has described the efforts in Manchester to approach it somewhat differently. You know, one of the problems in Ferguson was, potentially, is they have 53 police officers on the police force, four of whom are people of color in a community that is 65% to 70% black. So a police department's perception of who the community is and molding itself to reach out to the community as it is rather than what it used to be is incredibly important. You know, as Chief Mara knows even better than I, Manchester is becoming a remarkably diverse community. And, you know, that's a big challenge for the police department. It can't be a static entity. It's got to keep changing with the community.
Yeah, Chief Mara, you touched on this earlier, but let's hit it directly. You talked about all those diverse faces in the Manchester public schools and, you know, those kids will be adults someday in the community. What about enhancing diversity in police departments? Will that help build some of this trust that our callers are talking about?
I think it's essential to do so. I think that a police force, as any government workforce, I believe, and it's not affirmative action I'm talking about. I think it's just effective policing. It's about trust. Your police department should reflect the face of your community. I think, and it is a challenge. Right now, if you look at Manchester, our demographics, I think, and I could be off. I wasn't. Because of short notice, I don't have the exact stats. I think at this point we're about in the 80s, as far as 80% being a white. But if you look at our school system, those demographics are changing again. I mentioned this before drastically. And the future of Manchester is the face of Manchester is changing drastically. And as a police department, we need to keep up with it, and that is a challenge. Hiring is something we're working on. We want to attract minority candidates, qualified minority candidates, and we want kids, minority kids, to see a police car pull up and see a minority police officer and say, "Hey, I want to do that someday to be an example." But right now, they might not be feeling that way, and that's one of the things that we want to change. And as far as the militarization of the police department, to a certain extent, I can agree. If you're going to take a theft report and if you're dressed up in a flak jacket and you have a rifle with you, that's overkill. But society has changed. We need the equipment to protect our community, and how we deploy that equipment and how we use it, that is how we should be judged as far as this militarization. If you look at the way police work has changed, right now we have people that potentially it's going on across the country that can go into a school and shoot our children. And at that point, just go in there and just randomly, at that point, we want our officers armed and equipped to stop that. And if when we're affecting a hostage situation, a barricaded subject, a drug deal, drug dealers, we're affecting a warrant where they have a propensity towards violence and are known to be armed, that is when we need equipment. It's how you deploy that equipment, how you use it. But I do agree to a certain extent that we shouldn't be driving down the street with armored cars to affect our day-to-day operations, but we need to have that equipment available. That's just a change in society, and we have to keep up with those changes to protect our community.
Well,
that's
Chief
why
Mayor,
we need that equipment.
And I know you have to go, so I do want to ask you one last question, and you've been really generous with your time last minute, so we very much appreciate it. We talked earlier about violent protests in Missouri, mostly peaceful protests in other cities around the country. Are you hearing anything? Do you have any concerns about protests in Manchester?
Well, I don't ever have a problem with anybody protesting, and I don't have any information or concern about any kind of things that happened in Ferguson happened here in Manchester. But before I leave, I just want to make the point, and this is we all have to do it, all of us. Let's not let Manchester, let's not let New Hampshire as a whole become a Ferguson situation. It's let's use Ferguson as something to learn from. Let's address some race issues. Let's talk about it, and let's all get on the same page and to stop things like that happening in the future in New Hampshire. I think we can do it in New Hampshire, and it's just a matter of all of us working together and not being afraid to have a difficult conversation.
Well, David Mara, you rearranged your schedule for us this morning. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and bye to the other guests. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That's David Mara. He's Manchester's police chief. And Busher, Dottie Morris, let's finish out the hour with a couple more calls and emails from our listeners. Marion's joining us from Wells, Maine. Hi, Marion. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. My comment has more to do with how the announcement was made of the decision rather than the decision itself. It seems like the entire focus on this has been ginning up concern, anxiety for the past week. And then they announced it at 8 o'clock at night, their time, which seems like a stupid idea. It seemed as if this should have been produced with a little bit less fanfare and at a more reasonable hour. It seemed like they knew this was going to come up with, you know, it was going to create problems, and they almost fed it into it rather than letting it go as a you know, a decision rather than an announcement.
Well, and you're right, Marion, in that there was this whole week-long build-up, Dottie Morris, and boy, from what I understand, it wasn't just national reporters waiting for this decision, but there were reporters from around the world. The BBC was there and so forth. What do you think about Marion's point, Dottie?
Yeah, and I think that we are so hyped on sensationalizing things, and I think that oftentimes that contributes, I do agree with her that it contributes to some of the complications that we have post these type of announcements. And I think that in my mind, if there could, I think that the conversations, especially on a lot of the news outlets, could have created an atmosphere, or help to create an atmosphere where it'd be more of a conversation that could lead to a different outcome than let's sensationalize this and get some ratings and get everybody all hyped up. And now we have even more to follow up on. So I think that this whole need to make things bigger than you know, it was big, but I think that the media really did have contributed to it. The other thing is what gets reported is also something that can create even more of a problem once these type of decisions are made. So, if the reporting is skewed, or there's a perception of skewed reporting, then we fill in the blanks. And that's a bad place to go in our heads sometimes. And so I think that if there's a distrust of the media and a distrust of the criminal justice system, then what am I being fed and how much can I hold that as legitimate?
Thanks for the call, Marion. Buzz?
I think it's almost impossible to figure out what would be the right way to reveal what the decision of the grand jury was, what the right timing would be. One could argue every time's a bad time or every time's better than the one that happened. I think the real issue is in this case, as is often the case, the media tends to act far more reactively than is healthy. So the conversations that occur are starting to occur now, if they're going to occur. There was little substantive and proactive conversations about race in the criminal justice
right.
system and the really deep underlying problem in our country. You know, it was really overly incident-focused and reactive. In many ways, that's the nature of the news cycles we live in, unfortunately.
All right, let's take another call. Ben is in Hudson. Hi, Ben. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate
sure.
it. I just wanted to say, especially after what some of the other callers have mentioned, how it's unusual, all the evidence that was shown for the defense of the officer, and given the prosecutor's father was killed as an officer in duty, a lot of people thought he should have pulled himself back from the case. And I just wanted to put that idea because it seems like after everything that he really should have.
So the prosecutor's father was
an officer who was killed in duty.
I see. Okay, yeah. And some people thought he should have recused himself because of that. Thank you for the call, Ben. That's a legal question. I'll turn to you, Buzz.
Yeah, there's no really substantive law that suggests that one way or another. The way the grand jury process appears to have played out here, I think the prosecutor had far less role as to how it came out, other than making sure it was as comprehensive a process as possible, than a prosecutor usually does. So I'm not sure we'll ever really understand what effect that background on the prosecutor's part may have had. But the process itself, oddly, was fairer than it usually is, and so I'm not sure the process can be criticized as it was applied in this case. The real criticism is we rarely apply this kind of process.
Well, thanks for that call, Ben. And here's an email that came in from Jerry in Nashua, who says, so far I've heard many excuses as to why the situation in Ferguson happened last night. Jerry says there's no excuse for the anarchy that took place. The military vehicles that the police had did not throw the rocks, break the windows, turn over and torch vehicles, burn the buildings. Jerry says there was a criminal element that was looking for an excuse to run amok. What do you think, Dottie? Thanks, Jerry, for the email.
Well, I think that it's interesting how when people feel as though they've been wrong and not given a lot of outlets to do that, that this is one of the outlets that take place if you've been wronged. And I always think about, people like to invoke Dr. King, but this whole idea of violence is the voice of the unheard. And so I think that prior to all of this, people were speaking and, saying, this is what needs to happen. We would like to see some justice here for a change. And I think that, again, one of the reactions to being unheard or feeling unheard is to speak louder. And if the voice isn't heard, then something else will occur to be heard. And so that's the way that I think about what goes on, and it's not just that this is one thing. If it would be that this was the only thing that people had to deal with in Ferguson, if this would have been, and just one incident, but this has been a buildup. This has been in the making for many, many years. And so to say that this just kind of occurred in isolation and these people just decide to have a reason to respond to the pain that they had been living with for many years intergenerationally is to not to understand the complexity of what they're dealing with in Ferguson. So I guess that's what I need to put out there, is that there are a lot of complexities, and all you see is the end result. And the way that you can control a story is to start with secondly. So we're starting at the second part, but the caller needs to understand the entire story that led up to this. So no, I'm not making excuses. I'm just saying you have to take the entire context into account to understand the makings of what happened last night.
And there were other peaceful protests, according
yes.
to press reports.
Yes.
Buzz?
Yeah, I think to pick up on what Dottie says, the fundamental problem about race and the criminal justice system over 200 years in this country is we are way too reductionist in our thinking
yes.
that they're protesting and there's violence, therefore they're all criminals. And there's no excuse for that. As Dottie said, it's way more complex. And the thing that each of us has to do is be a lot less quick to draw broad conclusions and a lot more willing to understand everybody's perspective involved.
Well, and to you, Dottie, to close out, Chief Mara said, we need to learn from this. We need to work on this in New Hampshire. Let's not have a Ferguson in New Hampshire. Let's all get together and have this difficult conversation, about race and the narrative that we attach to people.
Right.
Where do we go from here, Dottie? What do you think?
Yes, and I know that this is being put together here in New Hampshire. And there are people who have been working on this for many years in the state, long before I moved to the area. And so we are in the process of planning something under the leadership of Andrew Smith. And, there are several other people, Mr. Willard Lett, his wife Brenda Lett, and there are many people who are really concerned because we love our children, all of our children in this state.
All right. Dottie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We grabbed you and Buzz Scher last minute, so we really appreciate it. Thanks for being with us, Dottie, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. Thank you for having me.
Dottie Morris, Chief Officer for Diversity and Multiculturalism for Keene State College, and Buzz Scher, it's always good to see you. Thank you also for being here.
Pleasure to be here again. Thank you.
Buzz Scher, professor at UNH School of Law with a background in criminal justice and civil rights. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our intern is Nate Graby. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.